At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Education Secretary Arne Duncan on the program today. With the demise of No Child Left Behind, the state of education in America. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 10th day of December 2015. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. President Obama put his signature on the biggest overhaul to federal education policy in a decade or more this morning. The Every Student Succeeds Act will replace the much maligned law known as No Child Left Behind, and in the process, change a whole lot of stuff about what Washington does to and with education in this country. Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education, outgoing Secretary, I ought to say. He'll be leaving the department at the end of this month. Mr. Secretary, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
The president signed the big education bill this morning that you guys have been working for years on.
Literally.
I know. Let me ask you this, though. If I am a sixth grader or maybe the parent of a sixth grader, which I happen to be, what's going to change for me in the classroom?
First, it's a little bit late for your sixth grader, but for the first time in the nation's history, early childhood education is involved in this bill, is in the law. And we're working very, very hard to raise graduation rates and are thrilled that those are at all-time highs. But the goal is not simply to have students graduate from high school. We want them being able to go on to college and take college-level classes, not have to take remedial classes. Mm-hmm. So now the law of the land for the first time ever is that across the nation, students have to be taught to high standards. So many of the things that we care about made it through this into this bipartisan compromise, and very, very pleased and happy to be there with the president today when he signed it.
One of the other things that's not in this bill, sir, that you mentioned, though, is a pullback, I think, can be fairly said, from some of the testing requirements of No Child Left Behind that you have allowed through waivers over the past number of years, different measures of success that the White House and the Department of Education have required in the past. I have to wonder whether you were wrong in insisting on testing and some of those metrics.
Well, to be clear, that's still in there. So we've said
but with much less emphasis, right?
It was actually the emphasis that we placed on it. Mm-hmm. So to be very, very clear, it was important to us that students be assessed annually. And that remains in the bill. But both the president and I have also been equally clear that in many places there is over-testing. There's excessive testing. So there's always a common sense middle ground here. And this law built upon our values of, yes, students should be assessed annually, but it also challenges districts and states to reduce testing if there's too much or if too much teaching to the test. And actually, we're hoping to put some dollars, some resources behind states and districts interested in that. So that is, we are hugely supportive of those ideas, and candidly, those came from us.
You have been prevented by law in this law, he says redundantly, from requiring states to do certain things. You're not allowed to offer incentives. You're not allowed to mandate certain curricula. I wonder what that says about the need for a federal Department of Education anyway. I mean, you have said that and this is just you the other day, that it's the height of arrogance for Washington to think that it can manage education in this country. Why do we have your job, sir?
We think about that every single day. What's the appropriate federal role? So a couple things. One is a focus on equity. And what we have done is put more than $1 billion behind early childhood education. This department spends billions of dollars each year to help students with disabilities, to help homeless children, to put resources behind the most impoverished children in communities. And we think that's a critically important federal role. Secondly, the goal is not just equity. The goal is excellence. You don't want equity around a low bar. You want equity around a high bar. And that's why getting enshrined into this law for the first time ever, the necessity that states have high standards, college and career-ready standards, is such an important step in the right direction.
You know, I appreciate all that, sir. And with all due respect, though, you kind of didn't answer the question. I mean, you said yourself a mere minutes ago in this interview that you want states and localities to have more influence. And yet here you are running this giant bureaucracy that's trying to tell schools across the country what to do.
Well, I again just beg to differ. And what we're trying to do and what I think we are doing every single day is getting desperately needed resources to the communities that need them the most. So I think there's a very appropriate federal role. There's also a very appropriate state and local role. And the idea here is partnership. This is nation building. I always say a strong military is our best defense. The best offense for our nation is to have the best educated workforce in the world. And we all need to work together there. The final piece that we haven't talked about is we put about $175 billion in grants and loans every single year to help make college more accessible and affordable. And while college is still more expensive than any of us would like, that investment opens the doors for college for so many students who simply wouldn't have the opportunity without those federal resources.
I'm glad you mentioned higher education. As you know, sir, affirmative action was back before the Supreme Court yesterday in the case out of Texas. There are protests of all kinds going on campuses across this country, from Ivy League to the rest of the educational system. I wonder what you, as the Secretary of Education in the United States of America, think about what is happening in higher education today in this country.
So, I mean, there are a couple different strands going on. So, first of all, the idea of making sure that our nation's colleges and universities are diverse, are inclusive, are welcoming to students from very different backgrounds. We think that is hugely important. And the president's goal, our goal, is to lead the world in college completion rates again. And we did one generation ago, and today we're 12th. And that is in no one's best interest. So whatever we can all do collectively to make sure that universities create a climate where students are welcomed and supported, and whether it's first-generation college goers, whether it's immigrants new to the country, whether it's English language learners, a higher education opens the door. It's the key to entering the middle class. And there's no better investment young people can make in their futures, in their families' futures, in the country, than to not just graduate from high school, but complete higher education, whether it's a two-year or four-year college.
Does college in this country have to change? Because that's what these students are asking for and demanding in a lot of cases.
I think many things have to change. I think colleges, we have to make college more affordable. One, we have to focus not just on access, but on completion. The goal of students is never to go to college, just to go to college. The goal is to complete. And yes, where students feel unwelcomed, where they feel unsupported, when they don't feel sort of a part of campus life and they feel isolated and alienated, that's in no one's best interest.
You're a young guy. You're not done by any means. I'm going to gather you're going back to Chicago. What are you going to do with the rest of your life, sir?
I don't know yet. So if you have any good ideas, let me know. got a lot of hard work here. I was thrilled to get the bill done today. That was a bit of a Christmas present. But I'll worry about what comes next after I leave here in January.
All right, sir. Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education. Thanks very much for your time.
All right. Thanks, now.
Up the eastern seaboard a couple hours at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in lower Manhattan, traders found themselves in a buying mood for a change. Barely, though, I got to tell you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you go out there and ask people on the street or at a party or wherever you go, if you ask them whether they think they're in the middle class, most people are going to say yes, absolutely. The truth of the matter is, though, that the American middle class is shrinking. That's the headline from a new survey out from the Pew Research Center today. But while Pew looked at the middle class, we thought we would take a look at the other M word, mobility. As the middle class in this country shrinks, Marketplace's Noel King asks, what happens to our ability to work our way up that economic ladder?
Many Americans believe that ours is a very economically mobile society, that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Nathaniel Hendren is a professor of economics at Harvard. He studies intergenerational mobility.
Contrary to that common belief, by most measures, the United States has some of the lowest rates of upward mobility of any developed country in the world.
He says the odds that an American kid who's born into the bottom fifth of the income scale will make it to the top fifth are about 7%. And he says the odds of going from rags to riches in the U.S. have always been pretty low. But a shrinking middle class could make mobility even rarer.
When you look across areas within the United States, areas with stronger middle classes tend to have higher rates of upward mobility.
Aaron Currier directs the Financial Security and Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. That's a different organization than the one that produced this week's report. She says there's a phenomenon that researchers call stickiness at the ends.
Families who were raised at the bottom of the income distribution or the very top of the income distribution are highly likely to stay there.
But if you're in the middle class, you're more likely to evade that stickiness, to move around the income spectrum over time.
People who are raised by solidly middle-income families actually have the most economic mobility, both up and down. They are equally likely to stay in the middle, move to the top, or move to the bottom.
If they move to the top, well, who wouldn't want to get stuck there? But if they move to the bottom and get stuck, Currier says, it's not just that they are more likely to stay there, their children are more likely to end up stuck as well. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
At the risk of throwing too many numbers into the same sentence, always a risk on the radio, as I think I've said before, there is a Gallup survey from not too long ago that is a great way to get into this next story. Just 13% of Americans with smartphones have a mobile pay app installed on said phone, according to Gallup. And 76% of that already small sliver of the population hadn't used their mobile pay app in the past month. So that gets us to this. Walmart is betting it can beat those odds. Shoppers in select stores can now pay using the Walmart mobile pay app. Heavy hitters like Apple and Samsung and Google are already in that mobile pay space, but the whole concept is still kind of newish. And to repeat myself here from before, not that many of us are actually doing it. So with the world's biggest retailer getting engaged, finally, Marketplace's Mark Garrison wonders why the mobile pay future is so hard to get to.
With nearly $500 billion in yearly sales, Walmart is big enough to have serious impact on the mobile payment landscape. Right now, that's not too well developed.
We're nowhere. we're really nowhere at the physical point of sale.
Karen Webster is CEO of Market Platform Dynamics, which advises companies on mobile payments, among other things. Here's why she thinks we're nowhere on mobile commerce.
One of the hardest things in payments in launching anything new is getting merchants and consumers on board at the same time and in enough density to get the new payment method geared up.
Walmart certainly has density, but that doesn't mean it'll be easy. Andy Schmidt is a principal executive advisor with CEB Tower Group, who spends a lot of time on mobile payment.
What they have to do, though, and what mobile payments has to do in general, is move past the novelty phase into the utility or ubiquity phase.
One way Walmart could drive interest is offering coupons and loyalty points through its popular app. To understand what's in it for Walmart, listen carefully to Molly Blakeman, a Walmart spokesperson.
Well, we see Walmart Pay as another step in making that our shopping experience seamless for our customers.
Seamless. That's got a very specific meaning to retail execs and investors. It's more than payments. The idea is to use the app to lock in customers and keep them away from competitors. It's called customer captivity, and it's one of the most powerful sources of competitive advantage. Mobile pay is also another chance to learn more about customers, which Walmart has been big on since long before big data was all the rage. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Smith & Wesson, this country's biggest small arms maker, reported quarterly profits this week, and suffice it to say, business is very, very good at Smith & Wesson. Frank Gerstenkorn owns Guns and Gear in Cheyenne, Wyoming. We talk to him every now and then to get some perspective on this slice of the American economy. Mr. Gerstenkorn, good to talk to you again, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's been a couple of years. We called you up because we were curious as to how business is for you in this time when the national debate has once again turned to gun control. Do you see that day in and day out?
Yes, we do. The pickup came right after the most recent incident. They're in your neck of the woods, and it's rolling pretty good. There's another thing at play here in the shop. I'm retiring, so at the end of the year, I won't be here anymore. But we do see a marked difference.
Well, so we'll get to you and what you're going to do when you're not working anymore in a second. But how significant a spike do you see when something like what happens in San Bernardino happens?
Very frankly, for a while, the so-called assault weapon, you know, the black rifles, mm-hmm. the tactical-looking rifles, were pretty staid here. They were not moving at all. They're going out the door now again.
Hmm. And what are people saying when they come in the door?
Most of them believe that they're going to wind up being put in a position where they're going to have to defend themselves and their families because there won't be resources to do that for them when the time comes. Whether or not they're knee-jerking, I can't tell you, but there's definite real-world concern.
Are you seeing sort of the overall spike in sales that, for example, Smith & Wesson just reported a great quarter? Are you seeing that in your business?
It's not as huge here, but here in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where we're located, there are a number of gun stores, so if you take us all together, there's probably a pretty good spike here, too.
Do you find, just in terms of paperwork and background checks and all that stuff that licensed weapons dealers have to do you find that to be onerous? Is it a problem for your business?
Well, it's not a problem until we make a call to the FBI to get an X check done. And
I'm sorry, a what check?
And it's a national background check
that
we do. And if a person does not have a Wyoming concealed carry permit, we have to do that. If you have the permit, you've already had your background checked.
Right.
So we call the FBI, and we may be on hold for a half hour. A while back, we were on hold for an hour and 6 minutes before we got the check finished.
Wow. And that's what you have to do to sell a weapon to a person who requires a check, yeah?
That's exactly correct. Hmm.
Seems like a long time. It seems like the FBI isn't ready to deal with the demand.
Well, you have to plan for what you think is going to be the norm plus a spike. Right now, they're really working. And we have a wonderful relationship with the people we talk to on the telephone. And they're incredibly busy.
Yeah. What are you going to do after you retire? Are you going to sell the store? Do you have kids coming in or a partner?
The store is for sale, and no, I don't have a partner. I've always been a little bit of a lone wolf here as far as that's concerned, but I own airplanes, and by golly, I'm going to fly them.
Good for you. Frank Gerstenkorn at Guns and Gear in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Frank, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Ken. Bye-bye.
Coming up.
It took way too long, in our opinion, for the state of California to get into this competition and recognize it had to fight to keep the high-quality jobs in production here.
Bringing the movie magic back to Hollywood, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 82 points, about 0.4%, closed at 17,574. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 0.4%, 5,045. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 2,052. Men's Warehouse shed nearly 17% today. Posted worse-than-expected quarterly earnings late yesterday. The clothing chain is down 68% since the start of the year. Ouch. In technology, LoJack, which makes theft recovery software for vehicles, clicked up more than 49% today after the wireless software company CalAmp offered to buy it. CalAmp brightened nearly 11% on the news. Some energy stocks got relief after a punishing week. Chesapeake Energy sparked up 2% today. The solar energy firm First Solar, though, down 7.6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.23%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. After a no-good, very bad, horrible couple of weeks for Chipotle, investors at least seem to believe things aren't going to get any worse. Shares up 5% or so today after the company's founder and co-CEO went on the Today Show this morning to apologize to the customers in 9 states who've gotten sick after eating there. Chipotle is scrubbing its restaurants and its image, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
These latest outbreaks started last August when people at a California Chipotle got sick from a norovirus. Then customers at Chipotle's in Washington and Oregon got sick, this time from E. coli. Then this week, people who ate at a Boston Chipotle got sick, again from a norovirus strain.
Noroviruses are indeed difficult.
That's Chipotle spokesman Chris Arnold. He says they're using a special bleach to get rid of the norovirus, and all workers at the Boston Chipotle are being tested for norovirus. Boston public health officials say there was a sick employee at that restaurant around the time of the norovirus outbreak there. Arnold says Chipotle has sent senior managers to its restaurants to oversee training and is trying to prevent E. coli by testing suppliers.
What we've done is a reassessment of all of the practices from farm to restaurant for each ingredient that we use.
Chipotle is also working on its image. Jonathan Bernstein of Bernstein Crisis Management has some ideas about that.
Everybody needs to be able to provide the customer with evidence that it's safe.
Bernstein says Chipotle should keep safety brochures on hand that workers can give to customers worried they'll get sick. And he says Chipotle should not say it'll become the safest place to eat, which is exactly what its CEO did on this morning's Today Show. Bernstein says statements like that can come back to bite you if there is another outbreak. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Golden Globe nominations were announced this morning. The movies, TV shows, and actors that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association deems worthy of its notice. Let me set the scene, though, for a somewhat different Hollywood story. Los Angeles. Early 2000s, film crews dot the streets and studios are fighting over locations and props, makeup artists and caterers. Movie and television production is pretty much driving the Southern California economy. And then other states and countries decide they want a piece of that action. They offer tax breaks and other incentives to lure studios and producers. And the L.A. film industry starts to falter just a bit. Marketplace's Adrian Hill picks up the story from there.
There's a point in many formulaic Hollywood scripts called All Is Lost. It occurs usually about two-thirds of the way through the story. And for Hollywood, that All Is Lost moment was right around 2013, when the industry says it was staring, no, make that falling, into the abyss.
It was a crisis problem.
Paul Audley heads up the nonprofit Film LA that helps promote film and television production in Southern California. He says production packed up and moved to Georgia, Louisiana, Canada. Families were pulled apart as crews followed jobs. Prop houses closed up shop. During the 2013-2014 development season, only about 40% of TV pilots were shot in LA, down from 80% a decade before. California made only a small fraction of big budget films. It lost tens of thousands of jobs, billions of dollars. Bleak, right? Here's Audley again.
It took way too long, in our opinion, for the state of California to get into this competition and recognize it had to fight to keep the high-quality jobs in production here in California.
But California did start fighting back with a lucrative tax package of its own. The state tripled its tax credit from $100 million a year to $330 million. The new package, which launched this summer, offers subsidies to big-budget films, millions to relocating TV shows.
Which now is returning some of that work back to LA where it belongs.
Bringing us to present day, the promise of redemption, a gleaming vision of the future, which looks at this moment like a $325,000 catering truck.
So here we have a deep fryer, work table storage. Here
that's
storage.
Chef Robert of Chef Robert Catering, a.k.a. Craft Services.
A lot of pan storage. This is a food truck on steroids.
Recently, his company's been dishing up tacos and pizza for the cast and crew of Westworld, Chips, The Last Ship.
For the first time ever, we've been at capacity in Los Angeles for quite a few months.
He's ordered $1 million of new equipment and hired 15 new people.
It's definitely picking up.
That's Gary Aneshko, who runs Reel to Reel Locations, a location agency like a talent agency, but it represents hospitals and mansions instead of actors.
Sometimes we have five shows filming at the same time at our properties.
One of those properties is a new location for the HBO show Veep. It moved from Maryland after California promised a $6.5 million tax credit. American Horror Story and Secrets and Lies have also come home.
The shows that are coming back are the high-value shows that bring a lot of jobs and a lot of revenue with them.
Big-budget movie production is expected to rise as the new tax credit kicks in. The L.A. film industry is also being helped along by the overall boom in stuff to watch these days and the fact that other states have dialed back their incentives. It's a change in fortune you can see all over L.A. Sunshine yellow signs with black arrows and mysterious letters or words directing crews to base camps. Roads clogged with bulky production trucks, star wagons. Colonies of porta-potties that spring up miraculously overnight. The threat to LA's film industry is far from vanquished. Production will follow the money. But for now, Los Angeles is a little closer to its days of glory. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I am nobody's idea of the world's biggest Taylor Swift fan. I mean, she's fine, but holy cow, is she a smart businesswoman. We've talked before about how she trademarked a bunch of different phrases from her latest album, 1989, when she was out on tour earlier this year. Today we learned she has filed to protect Swiftmas, as in Merry Swiftmas, everybody. I don't know, I'm thinking Kymas, Merry Kymas, Merry Rizdalmas, Merry Marketplacemas. There's a market there, I'm telling you. Yeah, no, I'm going with Mary Kymas. Totally. I got to get a lawyer for that. All right. The Dow up 82.4%. The NASDAQ up 22.4% there as well. The S&P 500 up 4 points. That is 0.2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you again tomorrow, everybody. Happy Kymas.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.